Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
I'm Diego Checo Contreras. I'm part of the Dissident Project. So I'm a Venezuelan born and raised, came to the States in 2017. And I did my undergrad in USF in Tampa, and I did my master's at AU, and I've been with the Dissident Project since earlier this year. And well, as probably you guys know, our mission is just to talk about our stories, right? Talk about my story, my personal story of living in Venezuela. We have people from all across the world that have lived through authoritarian regimes, socialist regimes, and why that's just given a life experience about it. So I'm really happy to be with you guys. But before I actually start, you know, telling me a presentation and explaining to you guys why it's called Upside Down, why Upside Down has anything to do with authoritarianism. I will start with a story. So when I was 15, I had a date. I managed to get a date with a girl that I liked a lot. So it was not that easy. I was very much a nerdy guy from Model UN. I'm still a bit of a nerdy guy, but back then it's really bad. I had brackets and stuff. It was terrible. So I managed to get a date with her after months of like texting, and she, I don't know why, said yes, right? So her name was Maria. She's long, black hair, brown eyes. She's beautiful. And, you know, I was extremely nervous, very, very nervous, as you would imagine. And I said, okay, the best way to deal with this is having everything planned. You have everything planned, everything will be pretty good. So I had everything, absolutely everything planned for that day. You know, where we're going to go, at what time, what I was going to wear, everything. Well, the only thing I didn't have planned is that I was actually living in Venezuela during the crisis, right? So during 2016, 2017. That's the only thing that I really didn't plan. So the day of the date comes, and a couple hours before I was going to get ready, but there was a bit of an issue, right? There was no electricity and there was no water at all in my apartment. Nothing. So for context, I live in Maracaibo, which is the second largest city, the best city, but the second largest city in Venezuela. And it's extremely hot. So we're talking about usually 35 Celsius, which is like 90 something Fahrenheit. It's extremely hot. You cannot be there more than 5 minutes without AC because you'll be all like drenched in sweat. So there was no electricity. I was drenched in sweat a couple hours before, so I couldn't take a shower as well. So clearly not the best before going to a day when I was nervous already, was sweating because I was nervous and I was sweating because there was no electricity and no water and anything. But you know, that they had to go on. I already had arrangements, so you need to just pull through. So I try to, you know, get ready, put some like perfume and stuff. Perfume when you're sweaty doesn't work really. Not tried. It's not really good. So I go out, I go with my dad's car, he borrowed me, and since there was no electricity, we actually had to like move the garage door like by hand in the sun. So I was even like the triple sweaty that I was. I was just a mess. I go pick up Maria, and I took her to a coffee shop that was near her house. And it was okay, you know, it was a fine day. Nothing bad happened, nothing terrible happened, but it was not a great day either, right? I was extremely agitated. I was not particularly in my best mental state and physical state. I was still like mentally was still taking the door out with my dad. But I said, well, you know, well, let's try and get this over. Let's get this date along and maybe go somewhere else. And maybe I can salvage this, right? Maybe whatever. So I go and get up and pay. We just had like a cup of coffee and pastry. I don't know what we had, like a muffin. I don't remember particularly. But so here's the thing. I think it was like 2015, 2016. So there was already hyperinflation going along. You just couldn't pay with cash. You know, you couldn't pay because you would have like a suitcase of cash to pay like for a coffee. Nobody has that. But, you know, who uses cash anyway? So I had my debit card. But the issue was that, and it was really common in the country, you couldn't pay because there was no connectivity, because constant lights going off, constant electric shortages basically made everything, all the Wi-Fi and all the telephones, go nuts basically. So I spent like 20 minutes trying to pay. I couldn't. I had to call my dad, who was still in the house without electricity. He had to basically run because he didn't have, I had the car, so he had to almost like run to a friend's house who had electricity. And in getting to his bank account and make a transfer, and they could send me the picture so I could send the to tell the cashier, like, hey, I paid, so we can get out. It was like a 30-minute process just to get it paid or something. So, and Maria, she was great. She was never like upset or anything. It was just like the situation of the country. But I mean, there was no second date. You know, there's nothing at all. It was not a very good date, in that sense. So, and you might be asking, well, what, who cares about your dating life 10 years ago, my man? I mean, what? But it's very simple because although this is a funny story and it's a simple story, and probably many of you have related in some ways to that, the reality is those things that I told you that made the day difficult, like no electricity, no water, hyperinflation, no connectivity, don't even get me started with talking about like gasoline and gas, which was just a whole different issue. They all happened because a group of politicians in Venezuela, they took policy decisions only based with the only objective of retaining power. That was the only objective. And the consequence for those policy decisions was to turn my life and the life of my family and 30 million Venezuelans upside down. So before actually starting talking to you about how that happened, I'm going to tell you a little bit of why that's important. Like, why was the context of Venezuela before Chavismo, which probably you heard in the news before. So for that, I'm going to actually talk about, oh, sorry, my family. So the story of my family is in many ways the story of Venezuela in the 20th century. So my dad, who's in the left, his family came from China. So my great-grandparents escaped China. That's why my last name, one of my last names is Chang. They escaped from China, from Canton, during the war, during the Second World War, during World War II. And they went from China to Venezuela, which is like a long trip and also very not very much similar cultures. But you know, Venezuela back in the 40s, back in the 40s, 50s, it was a country where you could prosper, right? It was a young country with promise where you could go there. And even if you didn't learn the language, which my great grandparents didn't, or weren't even from the culture, you could, if you worked hard, do well. So my great grandparents, they came to Venezuela, they met Venezuelans, and they started businesses. They worked a lot and they thrived, they prospered. My mom's side of the family is the other side of the story of Venezuela, because as I told you, a lot of Venezuelans, we received a lot of immigrants from China, from Italy, Spain, Colombia, all across the world during the 40s, 50s, 60s, and onwards, right? Portuguese. But my mother's side of the family, they were living in a very rural state, Táchira, it's called. It's like a mountainous state, very rural, and they lived there for like generations, and they moved from the countryside to Maracaibo, which is the main oil city in the 20th century, which is actually the story of Venezuela in the 20th century. We went from an agrarian country to a urbanized country thanks to oil, and a lot of my family, my mom's side of the family, went to Maracaibo to work. And again, they both thrived. My dad and my mom, they both went to college, were one of the first of their families to actually go to college. They had their own businesses. They met. They married. Eventually they had me and my sister, who's right here. If I don't put my sister in, it's mandatory to put my sister in the presentation. Now she's gonna like punch me and probably kill me. So no, we don't want that. So well, they had us. They met. They had a, you know, house, car. They had successful lives, prosperous lives. I mean, the country was definitely not perfect, and I'm gonna go on that a little bit later. But they were living okay. And my grandparents, they were living pretty fine as well. They went from working really hard in the my grandfather working really hard in the market, to actually having a prosperous company, a middle company, in Maracaibo. We were doing fine, and they wanted that same dream. And they told me every single time, Venezuela was a country where you could be prosperous, a country where you could live peacefully, a country where you could grow old. You can see your family grow old. You can see your kids, your cousins, your aunts and uncles, and your friends and your childhood friends do well. And you know, that was their life. That was the life of my grandparents. That was the life of my parents. And they told us these stories. They told me these stories. They told my sisters these stories. And they wanted that same dream, that same life for us, of course. Why wouldn't you? But that life, which for them was reality, for me was just a nighttime story. You know, it wasn't true. While for them, that was pretty much the story of their lives. For me, it was a night, a comforting fantasy, but it was a fantasy nonetheless. And why was it a fantasy, right? Why is this country that was so good for my grandparents and my great-grandparents and accepted people from China and Italy, and people from Italy and China wanted to go to Venezuela in the first place, which is like something's going on. Why did it become what it is today, which is we are only known for a migrant crisis, an economic crisis, and political crisis? Well, it's all because one promise from a man. So this man, Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias, he was a military officer who made a coup attempt in 1992 against the democratically elected president Carlos Andrés Pérez. And in 1998, he won the presidential elections. Now, why he won the presidential elections? He made the Venezuelan people a promise, and he offered us a deal. So despite Venezuela being much better back then than it is right now, it's by no means a perfect country, right? Although we were a democracy when most of Latin America was dictatorships, while Argentina had Videla, while Cuba had Castro, will still have Castrismo, while Chile had Pinochet, we had a democracy, a vibrant democracy at that. Having said that, the things are not perfect. So the economy by the 1990s was not growing anymore. It was stagnant. Sometimes it was falling, sometimes it was just stagnant. People didn't see a chance to have the lives that their parents had, you know, in the 60s perhaps. And the system was, they were pissed. They were pissed at the system. The system was not working for them. There was rampant corruption by the political parties back then, the traditional political parties, which were social democrats and social Christians, rampant corruption, and people felt that they weren't represented. They felt the system was rigged against them. And, you know, let's be fair, in part, they had a legitimate concern. This didn't come out of nowhere. So this guy came here and he says, you know, guys, this is not working. You know, this country is not really democratic. It's not working for everybody. It's not prosperous. You guys will not have the same life as your parents did. It's not just or equitable because, or equal in any ways, because a lot of people are living below the poverty line. And we have this immense natural resources. We have oil, we have this, we have that, and this is not working for all of us. So why keep this system going on? Let's tear it down and build something new. And, you know, I can be the guy. I've already demonstrated that I'm not for this system. That's why I led the coup against this guy, against Carlos Andrés Pérez, 7 years ago. I will build a new country. I will build a country that's more prosperous, that's more fair, that's more democratic, that's truly democratic and better for all of us. The only thing that I will ask for you guys in exchange for this great deal is vote for me. That's it. No, vote for me and give me a little bit of power. Just give me some power and I'll deliver. That was a bargain. Give me a little bit of power, vote for me, allow me to rebuild this country from scratch. And I'll give you a Venezuela, a country that you will be truly proud, you know, of being a citizen there. And you know, in some regards, he fulfilled part of the promise. He gained more power, actually, more than actually he promised at first. After he won the elections in 1998, because again, it was a great pitch. You know, it's a great pitch if you're living if the system's not working for you, and this guy proposes a radical change. A lot of people will think, hey, you know, why trying the same thing one and oh, again and again and again and again and again? Let's try something new. And he won. And the first thing he does is he rewrites the Constitution in 1999 and 2000, packs the courts with his friends and cronies, packs the National Oil Company also. Which is really important in our country, with his friends and cronies, packs the military also with his friends and cronies. And since he rewrote the Constitution, there was no institutional way to keep him at bay because he wrote a new country, basically. And that he did perfectly. He had all the state apparatus working for him. And he did, in some, of course, cases, started new programs, social programs in the 2000s. The oil barrel at that time was $100 per barrel, so we had a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money. But to be fair, those programs were not really aimed at creating a prosperous and sustainable country in the future, an economy for the future, or even a more free and democratic Venezuela. They only had one aim: to keep Chavez in power, to keep the power structure that held the whole thing together, basically. So that part of the deal went pretty good, but the other part of the deal did not. Venezuela did not become more prosperous, as you all know. Venezuela did not become at all more democratic. If anything, of course, it reverted to an autocracy. It did not become more fair. It did not become more just. It did not become even more equal, socioeconomically equal. That promise was broken, and that promise was broken. And this is a photo, actually, that's actually true. From Venezuela, people, I'm guessing 20 during the between 2016 and 2019, people ate from the garbage, looting for food in the garbage. And I saw this personally. It's not like, oh, this is an invention from like media. No, I saw it in my house. I saw people eating from the street, eating garbage, basically scavenging through our garbage can to seek some food. And these are not people that were usually like, they didn't have a home, or they were like living in the streets. So people that you could clearly see that had normal, like they were middle class, and they just got into really, really, really bad situations. My teachers in high school, I saw them lose weight during this time because they were not eating because they had to get food for their kids. They brought to school like a mango, and that was lunch. So, and why did this promise get broken? So in 2013, Hugo Chavez dies from cancer. And the economic situation for Venezuela also started to change for the worse. So the prices, oil prices, started to go like, and they took a nosedive. As we all know, if you have a country that's completely dependent on oil, and the oil goes down, you don't have much money to finance anything. And the problem is that we have incurred in a lot of debt to finance both the programs, the social programs that Chavez had, and most importantly, the corruption that kept the entire government pieced together. Because if there was corruption in 1990, when the price of the oil barrel was like $13, when the price of the barrel was like 100, there was even more corruption. And there was no institutions to keep it at bay because the institutions were dominated by the same people who were corrupt. So in 2013, the economy started to tank. 2013, 2015 started to tank. Chavez dies, and his handpicked successor, Nicolás Maduro, he had a choice, right? So his choice was, well, I can change. I can change the economic policies that brought us here. I can stop our offense attacks against private industry. I can liberalize a little bit the economy. I can, make arrangements that improve the conditions of the people, stop inflation. But no, he didn't, because that would also threaten his base of power. The structure that kept Chavez in power was dependent on having this type of controls at that time and having oil money to pay it off. So Maduro doubled down. He instituted price controls. He printed a lot of money, which created a lot of inflation. So we had, I think, thousands percent of inflation sometimes. And to put this in perspective, I know it's difficult sometimes to just think about inflation in this way because not a lot of countries had inflation, like hyperinflation. But for example, my family, we bought our home in 2014, 2015. Let's assume it was like 1 million bolivars. Last time I went home, it was 2018, and a bottle of Pepsi, which is like 2 liters, it was 1.5 million bolivars. So one bottle of Pepsi was more worth more than what a house was worth like 3 years before. So imagine if you had savings wiped. If you're living on a pension, wiped. If you're living on a salary, like day to day, a 9 to 5, just salary is worth nothing because by the time you get it, all the prices are already gone up. They go up every day, every hour they go up. So you don't have a lot of money. The money you have is worthless. Your work is worthless in many ways. And you have to do all you can to just get basic needs, get food, get water, get all the things that you want, gas. And that takes a heavy toll on the lives of millions of Venezuelans. And Maduro wanted to keep it that way because he needed to do that to keep in power. He didn't care if people were starving. He didn't care if inflation was 1,000,000%. The only thing he cared was to remain seated where he was. So one of the results of this crisis was an exodus. So 8 million, approximately 8 million Venezuelans have fled the country since 2015. We are a country of 30 million people. 8 million is like 27% of the country, approximately, right? Between 25 and 30% of the country. And they have fled in less than 5 years. If the US had this situation, it would be like 70, 60 something million Americans left in 5 years. That's the magnitude of the situation. I don't have much people left back home. My family was scattered. We all live in the same city, but now they all live all across the world. Some people live in Chile, some people live in Peru, some people live in Argentina, Colombia, Ecuador, Panama, Spain, the States, of course, United States, all across the world. Venezuelans are spread all across the world. And of course, this completely broke the social fabric of Venezuela. Venezuela was not a country where we had a lot of migrants before 2015. We were a country that, as I told you in my initial story for my family, we receive migrants, we receive people. Now we're going out, fleeing our own country, the country that saw us grow, and the country where a lot of people thought they were gonna die. My parents, they had to flee Venezuela in 2019 and start again at 50. 50, when you should be already thinking of retirement, and you think, oh well, the 401k that I had, the starting investments, whatever. They had to restart from scratch almost. Here in the States, and we were, of course, we're grateful and we're blessed because we're here in the States. But a lot of people had to restart in countries that are also not very much well economically, right? They have to restart in Argentina, they have to restart in Colombia, they have to restart in Peru. This completely broke the social fabric of Venezuela. I wasn't able to go home when one of my grandfathers, he was dying. He died from cancer, and he died like in a really public hospital, dilapidated public hospital, because there were no the back. It was like in the really worst time of the crisis. There was not even private hospitals that could had enough facilities, and we didn't have the money, and I couldn't go. I was here, and as a Venezuelan, and due to legal requirements, I just couldn't visit him. And that's the story of my country. That's the story of millions of people who have seen their families destroyed, their lives uprooted. And again, it was not because of war. Right, it was not because there was natural catastrophe. There was not earthquake, not an earthquake. There was not a tsunami. It was just politicians, autocrats, socialists trying to keep power, and in exchange for that, in order to keep power, they may employing policies that were making the lives of millions of people far worse than they were before. That dream that my parents had, the Venezuela, is no longer the same country. It's no longer a reality, and it hasn't been a reality for a majority of the people that are right now in Venezuela, because they've been ruling for almost in 25 years. And to be fair, we are not, Venezuelans are not cowards. We are not, oh, why didn't you go out on the streets and protest, right? That will be the argument. Why didn't you go out and do something? Why didn't you go out and vote? We did. We've always done. We're still doing that in all capacities. Even people with inside Venezuela, people outside Venezuela, we're all always doing the same thing, because we know, either we lived it like my parents did, or I know because my parents lived it, how Venezuela was before. We know what a democracy is. That's in our DNA in many ways. So you're talking about the country of Simon Bolivar, of Antonio Paez, we're talking about a country that knows what's to fight for its own freedom. But despite having millions of people in the streets in many years, in 2014, 2017, 2019, even winning elections, even tricked election, kind of like not very fair elections, but sometimes we managed to win them in 2015, for example. Even if we had that, the government still retained power because they had the army, right? And they had the military. And at the end of the day, if you have the guys with the guns, that's all you need, because you might have 1 million people in the streets, but I have the guns and you have not. So what's the point of you guys protesting? So regretfully, until now, and I don't want to say it like in a definite way, because I don't think that's the way that things work, but until now, we've lost. We've fought a lot. Venezuelans have fought a lot. These type of protests were like very common. All my family, all my acquaintances at least went to one or two protests, like massive protests. 2014, 2017, or 2019, or voted or anything, did something to get the country back on track. But until now, regretfully, we've lost, and Maduro has won. Maybe this will change, and I really have a good hope that it will change, but the reality is that they have the upper hand. The autocrats who have meticulously planned to retain power and to destroy the institutions have the upper hand. But well, eventually, I'm trying to end up a little bit with a more like a light note here. I came to the States in 2017. I came to USF in Florida, in Tampa. There's Go Bulls. So I came here, and although my life was a little bit upside down, of course, I had my family was back home again. My friends were, well, either back home or somewhere else or anywhere else, and I had to be here in the States alone and all that. Things started to go a little bit well. It started to get a little bit right side up. So I got my friends, met my new friends here, met some people from Israel, but people from all across the world. I graduated from USF in Tampa. My family eventually came to the States in 2019, so I'm really thankful for that because I know many Venezuelan families don't have that opportunity to live at least an hour away from each other, like a couple hours for one flight. Then I came to Washington, D.C., and did my master's program, and I'm working here right now. So things are going really good, really well. And actually now I have a girlfriend, so that earlier date that was bad, but now this first day we didn't have any issues with electricity or water, so that's pretty good. But it started to become right set up thanks to, of course, the opportunities that you have in the United States. And many people don't understand, not only the United States, but also I would say the developed world, because I've heard the same stories, people who are in Europe or other parts of the world. And the fact is that, of course, you have things, you enjoy things that you thought were like impossible, and many people take for granted. Just the fact you could save money, just the fact that you could do not have to plan for a shortage, electricity shortage, water shortage, or hyperinflation, or a government repressing people in the streets. That gives you room to grow and to live your life normally, as you should. Because when politicians are accountable, when politicians are accountable to the people, and they have to actually respond to the people in elections, they can't go ahead and destroy a country willy-nilly if they don't have the political power. But when you allow politicians to actually control the political process and control the state and control all levers of power, they can destroy their lives, and they will not care if they want to destroy lives, because for them, remaining in power, keeping power, it's a game, it's a way of life. For us, it's our lives, actually. So the important thing is always to be vigilant, because as you could see, Venezuela was a stable country. We were a democratic country. We were a prosperous country until we were not. And it's always important to remain vigilant on the threats against prosperity, liberty, freedom, where those threats come from. In the Venezuelan case, from the left, or sometimes from the right, but in the Venezuelan case, from the left, we always need to be vigilant, because that's, at the end of the day, we only live once. We only have one country. We need to take care of it with all we have. So, having said that, I'm open for any questions, and I will stop sharing here.
You're good. Thank you so much for that. That was very informative. And I always knew Venezuela to be a very prosperous country historically. We have a few student questions that are emailed to us, but this is from me. And guys, you guys here live, go ahead and message questions in the chat for Daniel. So was it an overnight thing when Chavez was elected that things began to change, or did it take a few years for him to
No, it took a few years. Yeah.
Okay,
So the thing
so
about, yeah, go ahead.
I was saying I'm starting to connect some parallels here.
Yeah,
But
it was a slow process, right? So it wasn't the usually Venezuela and Cuba, we get the same, like throwing the same similar stories. Cuba was far faster, right? Cuba, Castro's Department 59, by 1960, 61, all companies were nationalized, most opponents were either in prison or killed. Chavez didn't have the same base of support as Castro did at the first, right? So he came through elections, and what he first did was the constitution, right? A new constitution. He restructured the powers. He created a new judiciary, a new electoral council, and he started, of course, stacking them one by one. But he couldn't, just he didn't have enough the ability to impose all at once, right? So he started bit by bit. And first was the constitution, then he tried with the military. The military at first was really opposed him a lot. So after he purged the military, after a failed coup d'etat in 2002, he was able to expand his control. But it was a step-by-step thing. And of course, they were really smart, right? One of the things I don't want anybody to live here and think, oh, they were stupid, that they didn't do the they tanned the economy because they're just stupid. No, they're really smart. The thing is that they don't care about the economy itself. They only care about remaining power. And they've been really smart. They know when to push against political rights. And they also know when to just remain a little bit like, we'll keep the status quo for like one more year, two more years, and then we'll attack again. So it was a slow process. It was step by step. And here we're going a little bit more like political science jargon. But until, I would say, 2015, it was what political scientists consider Venezuela was a hybrid regime, or like a, not a hybrid regime, it was more like competitive authoritarianism, where there was authoritarian, who took the decision was not in question. There was no supremacy powers, but there was some, like, the elections were free-ish. They were not free, they were not fair, but you could win an election, basically, right? So it was not like Kim Jong-un, you know? So that was for the first 15 years. Then Maduro came power, and he closed the autocracy, and the autocracy remained very closed for 4 or 5 years, and now it's a weird period right now. But so it was step-by-step, if that would be my answer.
Would you say that, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Venezuela originally a constitutional republic?
How like when we
like,
founded,
or like structured like America, like with checks and balances and
yes,
and
all that. Yeah,
it,
I mean,
it was like that, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, Venezuela, and to be fair, most Latin American countries follow a lot of U.S. constitutional examples. So we have three powers. We have actually before Chavez, we were really similar to the U.S. We have the president. The only difference is the president only have 1 5-year term without re-election, but we have the president, we have two houses of Congress, the Senate and the House, and we had a Supreme Court. So it was pretty similar to the U.S. in that sense, and it was presidential, it was technically a federal, we didn't have a lot of decentralization and federalism, so that was one thing that we tried, but we never achieved. But it was similar. Yeah, the constitutional structure, it was similar. It was not the same. We had different election systems, of course, but the grand scheme of things, yes. Separation of powers, three powers, legislative, executive, judiciary. Technically, we still have those, but, you know, they're not respected.
Yeah, that seems like rules, like they're like, if we can't break them, we'll bend them as far as we can.
Until they're non-existent at that point. You
exactly.
Know,
so, guys, if you want to learn more about stories like Daniel's, check out dissidentproject.org. We'll have that link in the video. But one of our students wanted to know, can you describe the moment when you realized that staying in Venezuela was no longer an option for you?
That's a good question. I would say, I was 27. It was 2016 and between 2016 and 2017. I was, of course, my parents, we were fortunate. For a reason, that's when I came here to the States. A lot of people weren't able, but I could, and they protected us. You know, they bubbled us from the issues. But I could start seeing my parents getting every day more and more and more and more and more stressed. They couldn't make ends meet. They were doing all they could to pay payroll, to just get us food. And we were never starved, so in that case, we're good. So when I was seeing that, and I was going to the streets and seeing people eating from the trash, when I was seeing my professors, that really struck me. When I saw my professor, my teachers, and I was in a private school that was, they paid well, you know, relatively, and they were, you know, they're losing weight. That's what I said, you know, I have to leave. I love my country. I still do. I always love my country. But if I stay here, I don't see much opportunities to prosper, and there was no chance to just, or no hope of changing the government. I went to all the protests that you have to go when I was like 15, 14. I still went to the protests, but just the fact that the national government stood in power and they just killed willingly, repressed people, put people in prison, it said, yeah, I have to go at least for a time from Venezuela.
Yeah, I'm starting to see some parallels. And it's scary how easily it sounds like that happened in Venezuela, and how, you know, even here in the United States, we have that, you know, and that's all I'll say about that. We have a question from Italy, and this is Clara. Clara, you can unmute to ask. You had a very good question, my friend. Go ahead and you can ask Daniel. Okay, I think she might be having some tech issues, but she wanted to know, what would you like to say to your younger self?
To my younger self?
Yeah.
Ooh. Wow. Buy Bitcoins? No, I would say to my younger self, I would comfort him, basically. Say that, you know, things do look bad, and there will be a lot of change coming, because I was, once again, I was thinking, well, situation goes like it goes, everything will change, you know, my life will change, and I was worried about it. And I will say it will change. Things will go bad. There's no sugarcoating, but things will work out. I would say just calm down. Eventually things will work out. Enjoy what you can. Keep doing what you're doing. Eventually things will work out for you personally.
That is solid, solid advice. And you guys nowadays, no matter what you're going through, listen to that. Things will work out. One of our kids emailed and they wanted to know, in your view, what is the biggest misconception people have about the situation in Venezuela?
Biggest misconception. Well, one of the things I would say is that although we have a huge humanitarian crisis, sometimes people think that people don't have a life, don't live a life. How would that mean? For example, what do I mean? What I mean is that people, when talking about Venezuela, they say, okay, there's inflation, there's economic crisis, there's political crisis. And when they see, but people, although that happens, people still live normal lives. They still want to, like, they go to school, they have family, they want to just, like, go and, like, recreate and play football or baseball or whatever, like, have it, like, amuse themselves or whatever. So that's still... that things go on. And when people only think about Venezuela in the sense of the crisis, which is really important, and then they see people just living normal lives, of course, trying to survive the crisis, right, and surf the crisis to live a normal life, people say, like, well, that means that there's no crisis, right? And that's not true. So sometimes people say, oh, then if there's a crisis, why are there Venezuelans going to, I don't know, a baseball game? Right, that means that there's no crisis. No, it doesn't mean like, it just doesn't mean that. It means that people still live, you know, their lives continue and go on. The crisis, the economic and humanitarian crisis is something they have to actually overcome to live normal lives, but they still want to live normal lives. They're not always all day thinking about the political crisis, thinking about the economic crisis. They live lives like you and me. So I would say that's one of the main misconceptions, is that the crisis prevents people to live the lives they would want to, but Venezuelans still want to live normal lives because they are people like us. They're people like they have the same aspirations, the same dreams, and the same challenges that people in any other country. So I would say that was the biggest misconception, thinking that Venezuelans are every day either protesting in the street. If you're not protesting in the street every day, therefore there's no crisis. That's not really how it works.
That is very interesting take on it. You know, we can't thank you again enough for connecting with us. And it's just such an interesting thing because you are a primary source on this very topic, because you lived and you walked in those streets and you have loved ones from there for generations. We have a question from Kaixin, and this is from Spain. You should be able to unmute. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, in your opinion, do you think life is fair?
Life is fair. I mean, well, there's always going to be an unfairness in life because it's built by society, it's built by humans, and humans are by nature not perfect. So that will go to a very religious and theological propositions and arguments. But I would say that generally speaking, you could not expect life to be perfect if fair means perfect, or like completely just in that sense. Is it fair, for example, for me or my sister to have to fled our country for a decision that we didn't make because we didn't vote? We haven't voted, really. No, that's not fair, clearly. But you cannot let that or those conditions to interfere in your everyday life. You know, those are things that are beyond your control. I can't control what's going on in Venezuela. You know, like, people in America can't control everything that goes in the U.S. or people from Spain can't control whatever happens in Spain, in Congress or whatever. But what you can control is see how you adapt to those situations. See first, sometimes, of course, how you want to change those situations and how you want to respond to those challenges, but also how to thrive and live things within your control and live with your family, loved ones, and have a prosperous life or a thriving life, despite those injustices or despite those things that don't seem completely fair. That doesn't mean you have to isolate from the issue or like, I don't care. You still should care and you still should do whatever you have to do, but don't let all the conditions always define your life. Actually, try to overcome them in the best way you can.
Great answer. Great answer. We'll go with a couple more questions and we'll let you go. One of the kids wanted to know, can you discuss the role of international sanctions in dealing with regimes like Maduro's?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, of course, sanctions are a very hot topic. They're extremely controversial, and there's always questions of whether they are working or not. When we're asking about sanctions regarding, for example, Iran or Iraq, when the objective of the sanctions is to change the aptitude of a regime or the attitudes of a regime with other countries, that's one question. In the case of Venezuela, which the objectives were to force Maduro out of power in some way or the other, or force him to negotiate, I would say the main objective, which is forcing Maduro out, didn't work. That's clear. But they have also, in a really strange way, and this is something that you don't usually hear, but people in Venezuela know, sanctions actually forced Maduro after 2019 to stop being so ideological with the economy. So price controls, complete wars against private enterprise, those were the staples of Chavista economic policy for like 20 years, right? But after 2019, Maduro had to find more money. He couldn't just rely on oil sales to the US. So he actually had to he didn't become like Friedman, right? He didn't become like a liberal economist all of a sudden. But he stopped his traditional war against private enterprises to be as hard. You know, he just like, okay, let's live a little bit because we need every money, every cent we can. So in that sense, in a weird way, Maduro had to adapt his economic policies to keep power, and sanctions force him to stop, you know, price controls, just to allow dollarization to happen, to prevent, to stop putting in jail every single small merchant that he knew of, or like any small company that he had. Because he needed more money to keep his power afloat. So in that sense, that's weird. That's a weird reaction that probably neither us, nor Chavista, nor anybody expected of sanctions. So it actually changed the attitudes of the government because they valued keeping power more than ideology, at least Maduro. Chavez probably, he valued more ideology than Maduro, but Maduro values more power than ideology. So in that sense, it forced that little bit of a change. So the economy, Venezuelan economy, it stopped collapsing and it's just now stagnant. Having said that, you know, we collapse like 100% in 2 years, so stopping collapsing, you're still 100% down from where you were before, so we're still like really bad. But that's one of the things that happened with sanctions. And now it also, and the second point, it's also one of the few points that the few leverage points that the international community or the domestic opposition powers have against Maduro is sanctions. So it's a difficult, complicated answer to a difficult, complicated topic, which is sanctions.
That is, wow. I mean, it's just so complicated. Like, do you think, and this question comes from myself, do you think it was premeditated or planned, or like that, you know, Chavez and Maduro, like they were proxies, or like how did it all just go down? They just come into office and just do that, or was it all pre-planned?
We'll never know, right? That's a good question. I do think that they clearly, at least Chavez, had Maduro is very much reaction. He's reacting to the environment. But Chavez had a plan. He had a plan to change the political system of the country. He had a plan to change the economic system of the country. And he had a plan to change the society of the country. And in many ways, that plan succeeded. He, of course, there were some hiccups and against his plan in 2001, 2002, 2003, which almost, you know, forced him out of power, but he had a plan. He did have a plan to completely change the way politics work in Venezuela. And in that, he succeeded, particularly Chavez. And Chavez was more ideological. So I'm pretty sure he had more like ambitious plans of like changing the Venezuelan mindset or whatever, or creating a new man. Maduro, he's more, he reacts to the situations. He's a very cunning politician, you know, in that sense. But I think Maduro is more, he wants to keep power. And his goal is that. And so I don't know if he has like a ultimate plan of like what he wants to become. I don't think he premeditated every single decision that he took after taking power 10 years ago. He's more of a reactive type of leader. But Chavez, I do think he had a lot of the things he eventually made and created were premeditated.
That's a very interesting take. So before we let you go, I always ask this of all of our guests, regardless of what they're speaking on. Is there any advice that you could have for this next generation as they go off into the world and kind of blaze their own trail?
Yeah. Well, I would say it goes from the answers that I was given before. First, you always don't allow or don't let the bad situations to go in your country that are beyond your control to define yourself. That's one. That's a personal one. But also, that doesn't mean you should not be vigilant to keep in the country that you want, that you like, or the situation that you live in from getting worse. Never stop being vigilant about it. Okay, there are things that you take for granted, that my family take for granted, that my parents took for granted, that they were taken away. And they could be taken away very easily. Of course, every country is different. Each country has a different story and has different political dynamics. But the nature of people wanting to take power for themselves, that is universal. So I would say for new generations, always be active. Don't let politics define your life, but don't forget about politics, because if you forget about politics, politics will eventually get into your life, get into your day-to-day. So don't let it define your life, but always be vigilant and always take it as a civic duty to do the best for you, your family, and your country.
Solid advice. Guys, if you want to learn more, check out dissidentproject.org. Daniel, we can't thank you enough for joining us today. We will have this recording out and shared with everybody. I know I won't see everyone until after Thanksgiving. So if you're here in the States or you celebrate it elsewhere in the world, happy Thanksgiving. So before we go, can we all unmute to say thank you to Daniel Chang Contreras for talking to us about his story today? Thank you so much, Daniel. We appreciate you. And we wish you all the best, sir. Thank you.
Thanks, Daniel. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Bye.